Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of violence, child abuse, cannibalism, war, sexual themes, and racism.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Ozymandias, originally published January 11th, 1818, by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Throughout the foothills of southwestern Colorado, hidden wonders reveal the story of the peoples of the Pueblo III era. Following the collapse of Chaco Canyon, this became the prime destination for tens of thousands of people. Their cliffside dwellings, the urban sprawl which existed beneath them, and the dearth of pottery and other relics they left behind have allowed this era to become one of the most well-known histories of any pre-Columbian North American society. Ruins like Mesa Verde, Batatican, Aztec, and Quetzil have provided us with a wealth of knowledge about the people who were native to the area. In many instances, tourists are left with an overwhelming sense of awe and beauty at the ingenuity of the ancestral Puebloans upon seeing these ruins. However, the people who built these structures had no such thoughts about visual appeal or future appreciation by German and French tourists. Their thoughts were on the immediate survival of their clan and their village. It is with this mindset of survival that one must approach the Pueblo III era and the great abandonment of the late 13th and early 14th centuries, which overtook the entire Colorado Plateau and upended Puebloan society drastically. To understand what led to the Great Abandonment, which eventually brought about the Great Divide between modern Puebloans and their ancestors, we have to understand the ways in which Puebloan culture and society changed and remained the same after the central authority of Chaco fell into disrepair. We will also explore the reasoning behind their migration to new areas, as well as changes in their pottery and collective thought. The Puebloans' most renowned settlement throughout this period was Mesa Verde, located in southwestern Colorado. Contrary to the name, Mesa Verde isn't actually a mesa. It is a cuesta. Kyle Winder says, quote, "Mesas are flat on top and cuestas drain off to one side." unquote. Additionally, the natural design of the rock formation created a temperature-regulated hideout, cool in the summer and warm during the winters. The people who first lived here were originally called the Cliff Dwellers, and early archaeologists theorized that the settlements were a peaceful sect of people originally of Mexica or Aztec origin. This theory has been widely refuted by modern-day researchers who now place the people of Mesa Verde firmly in Pueblo space and directly link them with Chacoan migrants. Further evidence presented to Craig Childs by Kathy Roller Durand shows that the importance of exotic Mexican birds actually increased following the fall of Chaco. At the same time, turquoise, considered the most valuable stone to the people of the ancient Southwest, fell in importance as a trading good. Some argue this points to a new social structure amongst the Puebloan peoples, which emphasized equality, but this remains in dispute. The people of Mesa Verde were not only expert travelers, they were also master farmers and rock climbers. Their ancient hand and toe holds are still noticeable across many Puebloan sites. Undoubtedly, the ability to escape and climb were highly sought after traits, especially for the few who lived in the cliff dwellings. The Navajo, who inhabited the region vacated by the Puebloans, were absolutely astounded by these cliff dwellings. Their shamans claimed that those who once lived there knew how to fly, and after upsetting the ancestors, they were turned into the canyon lizards who crawl up the sides of walls. Dr. Jesse Harasta states that the agriculturalists of Mesa Verde created a, quote, unique all-in-one triad method, unquote, in which they planted corn, beans, and squash together. Each plant supported the other in their growth and development. Besides this, they continued the long-standing Chacoan practice of constructing irrigation ditches and check dams. These structures allowed the peoples of the region to take full advantage of the long growing season. As a testament to Puebloan ingenuity, more people lived in this region in the 12th century than live there today. As advanced as the Puebloans of Mesa Verde were when it came to irrigation, they were completely outclassed by their western neighbors, the Hohokam. Hohokam is a term given to the people by white archaeologists. It translates to all worn out, but it is usually taken to mean simply ancestors. Following the collapse of Chaco Canyon, the Hohokam began to adapt what some argue are certain aspects of Puebloan culture. Prior to this, the Hohokam had much in common with Mesoamerican cultures in northern Mexico. They grew a prodigious amount of corn, constructed unparalleled irrigation systems, and had what are called ball courts, where it is speculated that a sort of game was played. Their society, which was centered around modern-day Phoenix, Arizona, was brimming with tens of thousands of inhabitants. Hohokam society achieved what Chaco did and more, and all without any clearly definable hierarchy. They cremated their dead, as opposed to burying them in the fetal position, which was the common burial practice for the Puebloans living in the Four Corners region. This likely had to do with availability of wood, as the area around Phoenix was much more forested than the relatively barren mesas and buttes of Colorado and Utah. The Hohokam turned the alluvial floodplains into an industrious center for growing corn, squash, cotton, and beans. The labor needed to achieve this was immense. The Hohokam would create a canal by moving the soil by hand, using stones and sticks to break up the earth. These canals were sometimes as deep as 5.5 to 6 feet. In the Pueblo II era, 900 to 1150, the people likely moved as much as 400,000 cubic meters of soil and dirt. It's estimated that in order to complete some of the major dams and irrigation structures, upwards of 30,000 laborers would have been required. Besides evidence of Eastern Puebloan pottery being found amongst the Hohokam, there is no direct evidence linking the two cultures. Given the large amount of Hohokam pottery discovered in Puebloan spaces and vice versa, it appears that they must have interacted at least somewhat. The construction of the Big House, or Casa Grande, points to a deepening connection between the Hohokam and Puebloan peoples. This massive structure was likely built by the Salado tribe and might have operated as a fortified trading post or as an imitation great house. By this time, Hohokam culture had become saturated with Puebloan stylings. For instance, there were no more ball games. At the start of the 14th century, the Hohokam began to fall into disarray as they were unable to support their very large population. The natural resources of the area were depleted, and their hunting grounds were bereft of game. Come the Great Drought, 1250 to 1350, the Hohokam irrigation systems would also fail, and the people would leave the Phoenix River Basin and take off in several directions. Many of their descendants are the modern-day Odham people of northern Mexico and southern Arizona, while others join the ancestors of today's Pima people. As we've discussed, one of the most impressive feats of the Puebloan people was their ability to migrate with relatively no notice. Mesa Verde is a perfect example of this. It was largely abandoned by the people in 900, around the rise of the Chaco city-state. For 200 years, it remained practically vacant, but the people returned en masse. They surely knew about the location of Mesa Verde and what it represented to their ancestors. Mark Varian explains this process to Craig Childs, saying, quote, "Their landscape was not just a physical one. I think they were moving within a landscape imbued with meaning. Over the centuries, people left these regions full of objects that had meaning, and the natural landscape came to be associated with stories of things that happened there. They became not just buttes and mesas, but people and houses and burials and hilltop shrines. When folks returned to a particular place long after it had been abandoned, they saw something very similar to what we are seeing now. They found a landscape still alive and inhabited, even if no one actually lives there anymore." Unquote. In spite of the amount of focus put upon them, cliff dwellings actually made up few of the ruins found amongst excavated Puebloan sites. But the natural romanticism and aesthetic surrounding the cliff ruins have turned them into tourist traps of the highest order. The other structures which were uncovered were simple block-shaped dwellings. These were likely occupied throughout multiple generations by the same families or clans, with each generation adding to the building's layout. Upon entering the family, a newly married man would build their own segment of room for himself and his bride, while the wives and grandmothers oversaw their construction projects. In time, large families could conceivably begin their own clans with their own traditions, dances, and origin stories. These room block houses are almost always identifiable by their trash middens and their open space plazas located in front of the block houses and behind the midden. Although the polity of Chaco likely collapsed around 1150 AD, this did not prevent others from trying to replicate it on a smaller scale elsewhere. The most obvious examples of this are construction projects that resembled the great houses and great kivas of Chaco, but which were found in Aztec, New Mexico. John Stein told Craig Childs that the dimensions of the ruins at Aztec were almost an exact replica of Pueblo Bonito at Chaco. Craig Childs asserts that Aztec, quote, was Chaco reborn, unquote. Like at Chaco, many aspects of the ruins at Aztec are imported, with some of the wood used in construction coming from over 20 miles away. Just how real the Chaco-Aztec connection is remains uncertain, but it convinced Stephen Lexon enough to formally state that the Chaco-Aztec polity controlled this region during this time period. So, were the people residing around Mesa Verde and Yellow Jacket Ruins refugees, fleeing this oppressive force? Or were they a representation of it? The answer remains elusive, but if the former Civil War theory holds water, and these were two warring ideologies, Aztec ruins versus Mesa Verde, it goes a long way toward explaining the increase in violence, raiding, and defensive-minded buildings, which was witnessed across the Southwest during this era of rapid change. In either case, the people of Mesa Verde were at the pinnacle of pottery design and discovering new techniques in art. In one example, they began leaving their geometric designs on the exterior of their bowls. Their extensive trade with the South toward Aztec indicates some sort of regional affiliation connecting the two peoples. Amongst the many cliff dwellings in Mesa Verde, there is little evidence of inequality amongst the people. The one massive building has been dubbed the Sun Temple. It is a massive, D-shaped structure constructed close to the center of the cliffside settlement. It had high walls and was likened to a cathedral, but the true function of the Sun Temple remains uncertain, with some speculating it was a fortress or a central granary. Amongst the 600 separate cliff dwellings in Mesa Verde which have been identified, some of the most famous are Spruce Tree House, Long House, and Balcony House. Each has distinct features, and each likely played a unique role in the daily lives of the people. Spruce Tree House is perhaps the most famous individual cliff dwelling. It possesses T-shaped doorways, the function of which is one of the more hotly debated topics in archaeology. Some claim the T-shaped doorways made it easier to move in and out of the building. Others say it was to make it easier to preserve heat during the winter. Finally, Craig Childs postulates that they are a symbolic representation of Tlaloc, a Mesoamerican water deity. Longhouse seems to have been the industrious center of Mesa Verde. Reservoirs have been discovered alongside trees which were intentionally straightened for later use in construction projects. Balcony House seems to have been a residential area, with at least 40 separate rooms. It was improved and renovated repeatedly over the 200 years in which Puebloans occupied it. In the Great Sage Plain of Colorado, the people settled similarly. A single large structure, probably an imitation of the Chacoan-style Great House, was at the center of a ruin being excavated by Susan Ryan. She was certain that the people moved here because of its central location in relation to other major geographical landmarks. This settlement was occupied for hundreds of years, built and remodeled across numerous generations. Contrary to several other locations across the Four Corners region, the area around the Great Sage Plain bore witness to almost no violence during the Great Abandonment of 1250 to 1350. Susan Ryan claims this points to a societal choice to leave for greener pastures. During this planned abandonment, kivas were burned, likely in a ceremonial manner. Not far away in the Kayenta Highlands, a similar subsect of Puebloans who once hailed from Chaco were building a burgeoning community. Located in northeastern Arizona, Batatakin is one of the most stunning and beautiful of all the Puebloan ruins. Nestled in a cave, the village has been protected from extreme weather, rough winds, and raiding since it was first constructed in the late 1200s. However, the site was abandoned after only a few generations. Another famous cave settlement is called Keet Seal, located in the modern-day Navajo National Monument, and therefore under Navajo tribal jurisdiction. The cave was first occupied around 950, but construction of the famous settlement began around 1250. The site was in use until 1286. The fact that several Puebloan ruins exist within the Navajo reservation has been the subject of tension between the Navajo and the Hopi people. The Hopi are likely descended from the Kayenta Puebloans, and their modern-day reservation is surrounded on all sides by the Navajos. The situation has given way to violence in the past. Additionally, cultural and linguistic differences between the two people are pronounced. This division is most apparent in the example of the desecrated panel. As the name implies, this is a panel of Basket Maker II rock art which was purposefully desecrated by the Navajo. The story is related by David Roberts, quote, "It seems that several members of a Navajo family living nearby fell ill, circa 1950. The medicine man brought in to cure them claimed that the rock writings from the Sun people were the cause. The only way to break the power was to destroy the evil designs. The gouging was precise and selective, often obliterating the heart, head, or joints of an anthropomorph while leaving the rest of the figure intact." It is a gross overestimation to claim that the Navajo and Puebloan peoples have always been at odds. In fact, the Navajo hold many of the Puebloan ruins inside their reservation as sacred, claiming the ruins are home to many of their holy beings. Robert S. McPherson explains the Navajo worldview in his book, Sacred Land, Sacred View, stating that in the beginning, the Puebloans and Navajo lived in harmony, with the Puebloans providing corn and gifts to the Navajo upon their arrival. For unspecified reasons, the two peoples came into conflict. This resulted in the Puebloans, quote-unquote, displeasing the holy beings, and for that, they were forced to vacate their home in the Four Corners region. The question remains, what exactly caused the Great Drought and the ensuing Great Divide between Puebloan history before and after 1250? Like all things related to the prehistoric Southwest, we have little concrete evidence on which we can base claims about these people and their culture. But we do have several conclusive pieces of evidence which help paint a general picture of religious revolution, climate change on a massive scale, and new, intense competition with nomadic neighbors, or perhaps fellow Puebloans. All these factors tore apart the fabric of Southwestern life. One of the universally agreed-upon push factors which forced tens of thousands from the Four Corners region was climate change. Remembered as the Little Ice Age, global temperatures dropped significantly during this time. This caused hundreds of years of political instability, the collapse of powerful empires across the globe, and likely contributed to a phenomena in the Southwest known as arroyo cutting. Arroyos are rivers which are usually dry and only flow during the spring melt or during a flash flood. They cut their way through canyons, towns, dams, and roads, basically whatever stands in their way. The arroyos then permanently alter the environment through which they cut by severely dropping the natural water table in the area. The cause of this natural event is unknown, but human interference seems to play a major role. We know of two major arroyo cutting events. The first occurred in 1300, smack dab in the middle of the Great Drought, during the Great Abandonment. Undoubtedly, to a people who relied so much on high water tables and accessibility to fresh water in their dry farming, arroyo cutting would have been devastating. The final arroyo cutting event began around the start of the 20th century, and its effects are still being felt today. In 1980, in the small town of Kanab, Utah, an arroyo cut its way 30 miles into the earth and through the town, damaging infrastructure and houses. This instability undoubtedly led to political and societal turmoil as well, just as it does today. The climate crisis feeds the refugee crisis, which feeds the growth of right-wing populism and their xenophobic crackdown on immigrants and immigration. Perhaps a similar level of turbulence overtook the 13th century Southwest. This theory holds some weight, as is evident when one looks at the increasing signs of violence in the archaeological record. It was a time of depravity, where community members turned against each other just in the hopes of having something to eat. Unfortunately, some citizens had to resort to cannibalism in order to survive. Skulls have been found in prehistoric ovens. Massacres and crime scenes litter the ground under Sleeping Ute Mountain and amongst the ruins at Yellow Jacket. Besides the violence perpetuated while fighting over resources, there may have been deeper ideological and political motivations at play. Bruce Bradley states, quote, "Around 1250, you see an incredible change. Everybody's moving in the canyon, building cliff dwellings. At Sand Canyon, 75% of the community lived within a defensive wall that surrounded the Pueblo. All through southeastern Utah, northeastern Arizona, southwestern Colorado, the same thing's happening. Suddenly, at 1250, the tradewear goes to zero. And right at 1250, the ceramics revert from Mesa Verde-style pitchers to the kinds of mugs made at Chaco 200 years earlier. You start getting D-shaped towers. I think what's happening all over the Colorado Plateau is a reactionary, neo-Chacoan revival. Maybe it's a reaction against some new liberal thinking down south. The first glimmerings of the Kachina phenomena. The revivalists became hyper-defensive. It's a classic thing for reactionary movements to do. They fortify against the assault that never comes." Unquote. If Bruce Bradley is correct, this movement witnessed the depravity which existed during this era, and they believed that by going backward, they would somehow propel their society forward. Like today, they refused to accept the reality that their climate was changing and that they would have to change with it or suffer the whirlwind. Bradley postulates further on this reactionary Chacoan revolution, saying, quote, "I think the whole Chaco revival was driven by a single charismatic figure, a Christ type. I think we may have found him at Sand Canyon. In one kiva, we discovered a man, about 45 or 50, with his skull bashed in, and he had six toes. There are six-toed petroglyphs on the rock wall directly behind Pueblo Bonito. And even today, among the Pueblos, polydactyly, having an extra toe or finger, is regarded as a special gift. The Chacoan revival lasts only 15 or 20 years before it falls apart. Then the great drought of 1276 to 1299 hits. They kill their leaders, they burn their kivas, then they abandon the Colorado Plateau. They give in to new liberal thinking. The Kachina phenomena, by integrating clans and kinship groups, allowed socialism to flourish. It worked in the Pueblos for 700 years. It still works." Unquote. Bradley mentions the Kachina phenomenon several times, and it is a term we encountered in the first episode of this series, when we were discussing the fall of Chaco from the perspective of the members of the Hopi tribe. Needless to say, the Kachina phenomenon, sometimes called the Kachina cult, is arguably one of the most influential factors which pulled Puebloan society away from the Colorado Plateau and into their modern-day homes along the Rio Grande River and across Arizona State. John McDonald describes the Kachina religion thus, quote, "Kachina, also Katchina, Katsina, or to the Hopi, Katsina, are ancestral anthropomorphic spirit beings, or masked impersonators, amongst the Puebloan cultures of the North American Southwest." Unquote. These spirit beings, which number in the hundreds, are meant to represent the Puebloans' famed ancestors. When a Kachina mask is donned by a Puebloan dancer, he is supposed to become that spirit. It was incredibly bad luck if his mask fell off or his family recognized him. If properly appeased and respected, the Kachinas could bring good luck and rain. Besides Kachina masks, Kachina dolls are often sold as souvenirs. They range the spectrum from evil ogre-like dolls to rain-bringing lucky dolls. Upon Spanish arrival, all of these religious symbols were destroyed and deemed to be devil worship. It is largely because of this mass destruction and cultural genocide of Puebloan religious iconography that few examples of the Kachina phenomenon are still around from the period prior to La Entrada. Regardless, to help understand this sweeping religious revolution, we need to understand the founding mythology of modern Puebloans and try and work our way back. First of all, the Puebloan world is about as varied as any grouping of peoples who have been categorized together by some colonizing force. Languages, mythologies, and customs vary considerably, to the point where many Pueblos who are right next door to one another cannot understand each other. They also have completely different founding myths. This means that any founding mythology will be disputed, depending on the tribe which is analyzing the telling. Even within tribes, like the Hopi, for example, founding stories vary from mesa top village to mesa top village. In one of these stories, the first Puebloans emerge in the fourth world from the greatest Tsipapu, or spiritual portal of all, the Grand Canyon. In order to do this, the people went through the first, second, and third worlds, changing their physical form with each new emergence. Upon entering this bright new fourth world, the lizard-like qualities of the people faded away, and they became the first human beings. In many tellings, Tewa, the sun god, was ruler of this fourth world, while his nephew, Sotuknang, ruled over the underworld, or the first world. Humanity was created by Spider Woman, while Spider Grandmother planted the seed, which grew a tree that allowed the Puebloans to enter the fourth world. In a separate telling, Tewa grew furious at the disobedience exhibited in the third world and decided a great flood would wash away the greedy. Those deemed good were allowed to ride boats weaved together by Spider Grandmother through the torrent and into the fourth world. Native ethnographers argue that this telling depicts the initial voyage across the Bering Straits. Further investigation into Kachinas also helps explain the wealth of ceremonies and celebrations which occur in a modern Pueblo tribe, like the Hopi. In Hopi villages, the people believe that the spirits embodied in the Kachinas are not omnipresent, and that they spend a good part of the year on the tops of the San Francisco Mountains. When these spirits are present, celebrations and dances are performed to please them. These include the Wuwuchim ceremony, which consists of 8 days and 8 nights of prayer in preparation for a Pueblo-wide ceremonial dance. Perhaps the most famous celebration, which sent shivers down the spines of early conquistadors, was the snake dance, in which members of the Antelope clan performed a dance while holding a live snake. This is one of the few Puebloan dances performed without a Kachina mask. In Hopi mythology, there are two separate levels of good Kachinas. These are Mon Kachinas, which are eternal, like Kokopelli, and there are Dance Kachinas, which change and are updated depending on the season. Beyond this, there are a number of evil Kachinas, ogres and whippers, who will punish the recalcitrant if they fail to live up to Puebloan societal standards. Additionally, clowns and clowning play a huge role in the Hopi tribe. Clowns often act grotesquely in an attempt to dissuade the children from acting in such a manner around their elders and family. Besides this, clowns play a central role in certain Hopi ceremonies, with John MacDonald going as far to say, quote, "Clowning societies helped sculpt the foundations of Hopi ceremony and ritual, unquote. Mostly due to Spanish destruction, we only know of a handful of pre-Columbian Kachina masks and dolls. Because of this, experts on the Kachina phenomenon have been hesitant to officially date the start of the religious movement before 1300 AD, but almost all of them speculate that it likely played a huge role in the reformation of Puebloan society, both during and after the Great Divide of 1250 to 1350. Polly Schaffsma claims that rock art depictions of four-pointed stars are a representation of Venus in the Kachina religion. She has been able to date these back to before 1300, but whether these art carvings prove the Kachina religion took hold during this time remains debatable. Regardless, Puebloan art, ceramics, pottery, and society changed forever, alongside their ideologies. But with the rise of the Kachinas, it appears there was also a rise in violence. Hopi ethnographer and linguist Eckhart Malutki explains the mythological reasoning for human sacrifice. They contend that Musau, a supreme deity, explained to the people, quote, "Keeping the sun going will be possible only at the expense of human life. Only by flaming with human grease can the sun burn with such heat that it will provide enough light. For this reason, people will have to die from now on." Unquote. During the turn of the 14th century, many Puebloans died. Violence came from all angles, but mostly from fellow Pueblo peoples attacking one another. The weakest tribe would in turn be picked off by marauding Shoshone and Diné raiders, whose societies were likewise upended by the effects of climate change. At Sand Canyon, for example, entire pueblos were ransacked, and there's evidence of women being held captive, being subject to physical abuse, and then violently killed. Cannibalism was rampant, but Craig Child stresses, quote, "Signs of cannibalism appear to be very localized, in places where violence reached a peak," unquote. For a generation, maybe two, the people built watchtowers to better survey their terrain and be more prepared for an attack. These two proved inadequate in defending against the onslaught of violence. One such tower on the Utah-Colorado border is a perfect example of their futility. Inside, the bodies of upwards of 30 infants, likely an entire village's youth, were found burned together. In another, a dozen separate people of various ages were found butchered. It was a horrifying time to be alive in the American Southwest, and it's little wonder the people abandoned the region altogether. Perhaps the people left, fleeing this persecution and violence. Perhaps an advantageous tribe like the Shoshone delivered the final nail in the coffin for the handful of Puebloans still living around the Four Corners. Likely some mixture of these factors, combined with climate change and human destruction of the local environment, pushed the people away forever. In the end, they left with their neighbors. They needed each other, and they needed to escape. They would receive no points for stubbornness if they stayed. And the Puebloans understood that their 200-year-old settlements were not worth their lives. They knew they had kin somewhere to the south, and that used the mountains and hills as natural byways to their destinations. Nieve Zedeño explained to Craig Childs that the idea of mass abandonment and mass migration is slightly incorrect. The people were always moving. The frequency of movements at the start of the 14th century just happened to be especially intense. She explains that migrations are seldom straightforward affairs. People migrate to and fro for different reasons. Some people remain sedentary, but people, especially ancient people, almost always end up moving to places that resemble an old home of theirs or of their ancestors. All of Zedeño's data pointed to movements by the Puebloans, which were described as, quote, "two steps south, one step north," unquote. Besides their theological evolution, their society began to change as well. Their pottery became extremely sophisticated, there is evidence of ancient coal mines being dug in order to fire extremely fine, yellow, cream-colored pottery. They also used coal to heat their homes and enhance their fires. As discussed in our series on the American labor movement, coal is much more effective at holding heat, and it does so for longer, which was especially important in the American Southwest, as the wood supply was always scarce and dwindling more every day. This new process of using coal to stoke a fire was taken up during the Great Abandonment. Perhaps this supports the theory that this mass desertion was not as catastrophic as we may believe. Besides their artistic achievements, these Western Puebloans, who would soon become the modern-day Hopi tribe, were congregating in larger and larger settlements. Thousands sought protection in numbers on the high mesa tops, while others found shelter along the Rio Grande River. The fact that over 20 of these Pueblos are still there proves their strategy was highly effective. The Zuni tribe, a part of the Pueblos along the Rio Grande, have their own traditions, religious practices, and language. In fact, the Zuni language may be a language isolate, meaning it has no similar linguistic relation anywhere in the world. Their migration story was partially told to Craig Childs, who writes, quote, "People there at Zuni were given a choice of two eggs. One was dull and buff-colored, the other brightly chromatic. One group chose the colorful egg, and out of it sprang a dark bird, a raven. From this, they knew they were to remain at Zuni. The second group chose the plain egg, from which hatched a rainbow-colored parrot. These people were told, 'To the south direction you shall go,'" unquote. And to the south they went, using the Mahoyan Rim as a natural funnel. It was here that the Mahoyan cousins of the Puebloans from the Colorado Plateau had lived for generations. With the addition of their metropolitan neighbors, production and trade ramped up significantly amongst the Mahoyan. The people assembled themselves in relatively quick order and perhaps even constructed their own sun dagger. It was along this ridge that some decided to go east and settle along the Rio Grande. Others went south toward an uncertain destiny. The people who stayed along the Mahoyan Rim flourished for a time and created some truly revolutionary pottery for their era. The addition of migrant culture and style is most apparent amongst the Mahoyan highland pueblos of Kinishba and Grasshopper. They were both constructed after the Great Abandonment and likely constructed by Colorado Plateau migrants. At Grasshopper, as many as three separate cultures lived alongside one another and relatively peacefully for a time. A similar pueblo was erected at Point of Pines, but this was sacked and destroyed after only 30 years of occupation. Perhaps it was an unfriendly new people. Perhaps a rivalry amongst the Puebloans exploded in violence. Regardless, Kinishba and Grasshopper were abandoned. One of the pueblos which greatly benefited from the Great Abandonment was Pecos, which witnessed a population explosion around 1300. Pecos may have been inhabited as early as 900 AD, but with this new population influx, Pecos became a true boom town. These migrants helped build a massive 600-room pueblo, and within a few generations, they replaced the sparsely populated settlement below this structure with high-density Puebloan buildings. Thousands lived in Pecos and turned the settlement into a trade hub for massive wealth. The wealth created here proved to be this pueblo's downfall, and after a series of brutal raids, it was crippled. It would be one of the last pueblos abandoned, with the last inhabitants departing in the mid-19th century. Another place which benefited immensely from this migratory explosion was the northern Mexican Casas Grandes culture, not to be confused with Casa Grande in Arizona. These people may have been Puebloan-inspired Mesoamericans or Mesoamerican-inspired Puebloans. Either way, they built a massive settlement where approximately 4,000 people lived and worked. This veritable city is remembered as Pakume. They survived and thrived as a southern center for trade, rivaling Pecos to the north. The settlement was abandoned by 1450 AD, with local hunter-gatherers explaining to newly arrived conquistadors that the city lost the war to the Opata people of western Mexico, and the survivors left for the Rio Grande. Another theory speculates that the people of Casas Grandes intentionally abandoned the settlement and became the Opata. As the 14th century ended, Puebloan society grew to unprecedented heights. About 80,000 Puebloans lived and worked for several generations of relative peace. They would live this way until the Europeans came, first in trickles, and then in drabs. Spanish colonization, with all its starts and stops over the course of the 16th century, would eventually take hold, and it would destroy the fabric of Puebloan life much more than the Great Divide of the 14th century ever could have. However, both the destructive forces of the Great Divide and La Entrada would not be strong enough to end Puebloan civilization. Their culture and ideologies were forced underground by names which are plastered on countless streets and statues across the United States today. Without careful study of history, surnames like Coronado and Oñate would just be the names of boulevards and roads. With the study of history in mind, they take on a new, dark meaning. They are the names of North America's first recorded butchers. On the next episode of Turning Tides, Puebloan society will be confronted by the first waves of Pahanas, white men from the south. They will bring unprecedented amounts of war, enslavement, disease, and death. Even under the weight of this oppression, however, the Puebloan peoples will band together and lay a seed of rebellion, which will bloom into revolution, independence, and momentary freedom and self-government. I hope you'll join me then for the havoc of La Entrada. I'm your host, Joseph Pascón. Have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.